From the heart of the seacoast, from the hearts of book lovers, from the deepest depths of the library stacks, from the people behind the desk, we bring you Portsmouth Public Library's audio extravaganza, The Parrot Unbound. With interviews, panels, lectures, sketches, literature, reviews, and more, the library is honored to present The Parrot for your listening pleasure. Let us take you on a journey.
Welcome to Episode 5 of The Parrot Unbound, Portsmouth Public Library's podcast. You can hear us on SoundCloud and on WSEA Portsmouth Community Radio. I'm Laura Horwood-Benton, Public Programming and Community Relations Librarian. You just heard our intro read by Assistant Director Christine Fries. Christine's top qualities include her compassionate leadership style and how fabulous she looks in royal blue. In this episode, Steve interviews Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire Executive Director Jerrianne Bogus, and Grace interviews University of New Hampshire Professor Kabria Baumgartner about Black history in New England. You'll also hear highlights from our September 2018 Culture Keepers, Culture Makers panel discussion, learn about library history with Polina, and listen to Mary Jo and Michaela hype the Saga series. Finally, Steve interviews former library assistant Titus, who had the brilliant idea to start this very podcast. Thanks, Titus. This is The Parrot Unbound from Portsmouth Public Library.
Hello, this is Steve Butzel, director of the Portsmouth Public Library, and I am joined in my office by Jerrianne Bogus, executive director of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire. Born in Jamaica, Ms. Bogus moved to the United States in 1977 and has been a long-term resident of Milford, New Hampshire. She has published several books, including Harriet Wilson's New England, Race, Writing, and Region, and a collection of essays, the first devoted entirely to Wilson and her novel. In 2015, Bogus was named by the New Hampshire Humanities Council as one of the 40 most influential New Hampshireites who have vastly enriched human understanding and whose original works and passion for excellence have put New Hampshire on the cultural map. And in 2017, she was the winner of the Seacoast NAACP Freedom Fighter Award. So welcome, Jerrianne.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Why don't you begin by telling those who are listening who may not be familiar with the Black Heritage Trail, when it was founded, sort of what its mission is, anything else you'd like people to know about the organization?
Well, the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire is an outgrowth of the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail, which was started almost 25 years ago. Next year, the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail will celebrate its 25th anniversary. By Valerie Cunningham, we were looking at the work that the Portsmouth Black Heritage Trail was doing and found out that we were talking a lot about other histories, other Black history in other parts of the state. You know, Harriet Wilson in Milford, Noyes Academy in Canaan, Coit Mountain in Andover, and so on. And then we decided that the Black history story is not just in Portsmouth, so it's a state story. So we formed, in 2016, a group of us got together and formed what is now the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire.
So for the second year in a row, the Portsmouth Public Library has been honored to co-host several of the Black Heritage Trail of New Hampshire Eleanor Williams Hooker Tea Talks. Through shared stories and dialogues, these Sunday afternoon gatherings have explored conflicts and presented ideas on how we as a nation can move beyond tensions related to race, religion, gender, wealth, and income, amongst other issues. Each one has been really riveting, informative, and extremely well attended, and it seems you and your organization have struck a chord with many in the Seacoast and probably around the state. What do you accredit that to?
There's a couple things. I think one main thing I would say is that we create these tea talks around topical subjects with kind of grounded in history and talking about exploring the history that we don't really talk about in our country. So there's that interest there. People are interested in knowing more about who our neighbors are, knowing more about, you know, how we got here. And of course, are, it seems right now that our country is really divided and going back on, you know, divided on racial lines around issues of gender, you know. And so I think people just really want to know more. We've realized that Black history is not really taught in schools, and people live their whole lives and get to retirement age and go, I never knew this about New Hampshire. I never knew this about Blacks in my neighborhood. So I think that we're just in a time where people really want to know more and create a space where we can come together and feel more united than this divisiveness.
What Tea Talk topics have you most enjoyed developing programs around, and do you have a favorite Tea Talk program of all time?
Of all time.
Or maybe just the first question, what topics have you really most enjoyed exploring?
That's like asking which one of your children you like best. I really put together programs, this may sound selfish, but topics that I want to know more about, you know? And I'm hopeful if I'm interested in it, other people will be too. I'm really a little biased in looking at how Native Americans and African Americans, you know, the history of being so marginalized, mm-hmm. how our history connects, you know, how we disappear from the areas, people's knowledge, the collective memory, the social network, you know, and all of that. So really turning the narrative around to really look at these things really interests me. I think for this season, that what we just finished, the dialogue between Shea Boulé, Black Girl in Maine, and Debbie
Waking
Irving.
Up White,
yeah. Debbie Irving, Waking Up White, was amazing. You know, they were really willing to go in these really vulnerable places of talking. And what it reminded me of is most countries where you've gone through traumatic genocide, or, you know, really the mistreatment of one group by another, they've had a period of reconciliation, mm-hmm. where people would come and just tell their truths, just be out in the open and talk. And we haven't had that in our country here. So opportunities like this where people are just open and honest about how they feel about issues of race, how things were racialized, how you dialogue with each other across these racial lines, are so important. And if you're willing to be honest, vulnerable, and open, I think we as a country, you know, that model would work. It's worked well for all the other countries, mm-hmm. you know, South Africa, Rwanda. It's not perfect, but it starts the dialogue of healing.
I noticed on your website that the Black Heritage Trail New Hampshire's Spring Symposium is titled Emancipation and the 13th Amendment, The Legacy of Enslavement. Could you give us a preview of what that event will be like? And I wonder if the issue of reparations will be discussed. I know that's come up at some of the Tea Talk events that I've been to.
I really wanted to look at the work, you know, the psychological effect of enslavement. Again, this whole part of reconciliation and talking, you know, being willing to talk in the public about subjects we don't normally talk about and create these safe spaces where people can, you know, have those dialogues. So I wanted to look what the psychological effect of enslavement is, not only on African Americans, but also on, you know, white majority Americans, because these things don't go in isolation. You know, it's not only something that affects one race and doesn't affect the other. So we've put together two really, really good academians and scholars and independent scholars who have dealt with these issues and who have talked on these things, like, you know, from implicit bias to where we are now, and how we're not even aware of these things. Mm-hmm. So Dottie Morris from Keene State. And I like these dialogues between races. So mm-hmm. we have an African-American, Dottie Morrison from Keene, who will present, you know, her point of view on the psychological effect and where we are. And it'll be an interactive dialogue, like a workshop. And James DeWolf Perry, part of the DeWolf family from Rhode Island, who's been doing a lot of work on enslavement and the dialogues around it. And then he'll represent the other side. Because our programs are not just academic, you know, we get to the heart as well. All the programs that I have, we try to create this heart piece where people will understand. We're not just, you know, reading an academic paper. I also have a young woman who's done some genealogy, African-American woman from Boston, who's done genealogic work on her family. And they happen to actually live in New Hampshire. But she does an artistic piece by telling the story through quilt making.
Wow.
So she Beautiful. Will talk about that psychological effect through her art.
I know that at least one or two of the talks I've been to, that oftentimes there's been, one of the speakers has sung, you know, or there's been music, and it really does move you into your body and into your heart and out of your head, in addition to all of the academic or cultural commentary. So,
part of the thing that we really say we want to do, our real, you know, ideal goal is to engage hearts and mind.
Yeah.
You know, so engage hearts and mind in a way to create spaces where people see each other as humans and not as stereotypes.
The last question that I have, having been born in Jamaica and moved to the United States, it sounds like it shaped your vision, your view of heroes and heroism. Are there any other comments you might have about how it influenced your life around living in the United States, specifically around the issues of race or gender or anything else you'd like to add?
So what I tell people a lot when I talk about coming from Jamaica is coming from a country where you're the majority, you come in a country with a majority mindset. The way you think, the way you walk, the way you talk is different than if you were born in a country that has a long history of squashing your underrepresented folks. So I came in with a majority mindset. And when I first came here, I moved to Alabama and then moved north. And I tell people all the time, I'm glad I went south before coming north, or else the transition would have been much harder coming from Jamaica directly to coming to New Hampshire. Because down south, people were much more like folks at home, black and white, in that people greeted you. I say hello. You never pass somebody without at least acknowledging their presence. And if they don't like you, they tell you right out, and they tell you why they don't like you.
Uh-huh.
So it was really clear, you know, if you were in a situation where somebody didn't like you because you're black, they're going to tell you. But in the north, you have no clue. People don't even see you when you're walking on the street. You know, it's a little dance until they get to know you. You know, you could be next door to your neighbor for 100 years and never say hi. You have to hear, you have to make the effort to know people. And once you do that, it's better. But you have to be the one to meet.
One last question that I'm just going to add on actually has to do with, well, two topics. One is the lynching museum that's opened recently in the United States, and I wonder what your feelings are about that museum as a beginning of sorts of reckoning, of a reconciliation or an acknowledgement of the past. And the other is that I just went to an exhibit at the Peabody Essex Museum where they had a land acknowledgement at the beginning that acknowledged that the land that the museum was on was ancestral lands of Native American tribes. And I was very moved by that. And I thought, this is the sort of thing that shows some openings, some change. So those are just two other ideas or experiences I've had recently. I wonder what you think about those.
I think those are both brilliant and exactly where we need to be in creating inclusive histories. If we take the monument, the African Burying Ground Memorial here in Portsmouth, nobody can ever say again that there was not enslavement here in Portsmouth, right? Because there, it's visible, it's talked about, and it's now known, unless somebody comes and wipes it all out again. But for now, and it's the starting point of a dialogue. You know, if you see that monument, you go, what happened here? It's the same thing for Native American lands. We never start our tours for the Black Heritage Trail without first acknowledging that Native Americans were here before European contact.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't want to perpetuate that misnotion. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to the Lynching Museum this month on the 22nd through the 26th, so I'm looking forward to it. And I was at a conference where somebody was doing a review on it, and they were talking about these bottles of dirt, you know, of where the lynching happens. And her analysis of looking at this was that bottle captured the lynched person and the person doing the lynching in that one spot. And if you think of it, just thinking of those two peoples, their energies, their stories, their being forever captured in that bottle, it broadened for me, it just broadened up the whole notion that we're all here in this earth. This one earth, that we have to start really taking care of each other and looking at this. There's no escaping it from the past to where we are now. So putting that history out, telling that story, the same spot where these two people walked on at that moment in time captured a great evil. And we hid that. We didn't want to visualize it. And we're all going back to that earth. You know, that's that real primal knowledge of what it means to be human. We're from dirt and we'll return to dirt. None of us can escape that.
This is Grace, the Library and Community Relations page. Today I'm speaking with Cabrilla Baumgartner, an Assistant Professor of American Studies at UNH, as well as a core faculty member in the Women's Studies program and a faculty affiliate in the History Department. I'm currently taking her class, Intro to African American Literature and Culture, Time, Place, and Belonging. So Professor Baumgartner, I wanted to talk to you because your teaching and writing overlaps with the work of Gerianne Bogus, who also contributed to this episode of the podcast. You actually play a documentary featuring Gerianne Bogus in your class.
That's right.
And the clip we watched is about Harriet Wilson, who is this major figure in New Hampshire literature and African American literature, but who I hadn't heard of until my senior year of college. So for listeners who aren't familiar with Harriet Wilson, can you talk a bit about her life and her place in history?
Absolutely. So I actually didn't know much about Harriet Wilson either when I was an undergraduate student in college. And as I started to do more research on African-American women in the Northeast, she came up and her novel came up. And it came up in part because her novel, we think, was one of the first, if not the first novel written by an African-American woman. And so I thought, you know, I studied in Los Angeles at UCLA. And, you know, I took a course on African-American literature, but I don't recall reading Arnig. And sure, I'm pretty sure I probably came across it in a text that was mentioned, but I hadn't really read it. And so when I arrived here at UNH, I thought this would definitely be a novel that I assign. And I want to talk about Harriet Wilson as sort of part of the literary heritage, not just of, you know, African-Americans, but also of New Hampshire, and sort of to place her in that conversation. So Harriet Wilson, the novel is sort of semi-autobiographical. She's a mixed-race African-American woman growing up in New Hampshire. She's abandoned by her mother, and she has to sort of make a way for herself. And so she's sort of, you know, dropped off at the Belmonts' house, and she's mistreated. She's abused as a girl, as a teenager. And all that she can think about is sort of, you know, fleeing, right? Getting to freedom, so to speak. So I think it's an interesting semi-autobiographical novel, in part because it's kind of like a freedom narrative. She's indentured, although there's no evidence of a contract, but she feels compelled to stay, I think forced to stay at the Belmont House. And she's just sort of working her whole life to try to, you know, to be free. She eventually leaves the house, and we think she moves to Boston, and she eventually, I believe, becomes a teacher and also has this sort of hair care product that she sells. Prior to that, she has a son. So her life at the end of her life, right, looks very different than the beginning of her life. And she becomes sort of part of Boston's Black community by the late 19th century. So hers is, I think, is a really interesting story. It has sort of all the hallmarks of, you know, overcoming struggle, you know, being who you are, finding freedom, right? All of these sort of great ideas that we, you know, associate with literature and particularly with the African-American experience, you see that in her life.
And how do you approach the title of the book when you teach it?
So that's a great question. I actually had not thought a lot about the title in that I didn't think that students would have difficulty with it, except one of my students came up to me and she said that her father had seen that she was sort of purchasing this book, and her father sort of asked her, what is this that you're purchasing?
That actually happened to me with my dad.
That's right. Okay, so I don't
know
if it's
on
your
table.
I know.
Was like, what is this?
What is this, right? So it was another student that had the same, same issue or moment. And I guess I had read the book so many times, I'd seen the title so many times that it didn't cause any pause for me. But then I thought about it, and I'm like, wait a second, this title is actually very important. So I oftentimes talk about how Henry Louis Gates approached the novel, where he found it in a bookstore. He saw the title, thought it was interesting, and then sort of in that sense discovered it. I think it's important to read the title, The Words Are Nick, but also to read the, if you want to call it the subtitle, the title of it is something like Shadows Fall North. I think that the book is, in that sense, has two titles. The first one, so we have to confront, because what the Belmont family is basically doing is they're enslaving a child who becomes a teenager and then is finally freed. And so we have to think about slavery as it exists in the North, maybe not called that, but that there are these forms of unfree labor. And indentured servitude, or servitude, was one of those forms of unfree labor that disproportionately impacted Black girls and women. And I think the title sort of reminds us of that, because the Belmonts want their own nig, our nig, and so it does conjure up in associations with a racial slur, but I think that Wilson is using it to remind us that even though slavery in some of the states in the North had been abolished, or most of the states, all the states really had been abolished by that point, that there still was sort of what we might call a residue of slavery, right, still existing. And in that way, Wilson's novel sort of makes us confront that.
And some of my fellow students in your class are currently working on a final project that seeks to persuade New Hampshireites that Harriet Wilson should be required reading in high schools. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think that it should be required reading. I think Harriet Wilson is one of those writers who sort of is native to New Hampshire, has a lot of insights that she shares in her novel about New Hampshire and about the North in general. I think it's the kind of novel that we shouldn't shy away from, and know that there are difficult issues that we have to face in that novel, difficult moments in that novel, particularly around, you know, abuse, but we can't really ignore it. And so I would like to think that, well, that New Hampshireites would be sort of proud that there was someone like Harriet Wilson who found the time and the resources to publish her own story, that that's something that we could celebrate, and that actually, you know, high school students might see parallels between their own life and that of Harriet Wilson.
In addition to teaching, you're currently working on the manuscript of your first book, mm-hmm. In Pursuit of Knowledge, Black Women and Educational Activism in Antebellum America. What drew you to this project?
Great question. So I started researching the project 10 years as a graduate student at UMass Amherst. And I came across this sort of episode in history involving a white Quaker woman by the name of Prudence Crandall. She opened a school for African-American girls and women in 1833. And 17 months later, that school closed. And I was very interested in understanding sort of what happened, sort of what motivated her to open this school, who were the young Black girls and women who came to the school, and then why did it close? And so as I sort of traced what happened in that event, I started to see that there were connections to other Black girls and women in the North. So there's another case that I talk about in upstate New York. There's even a connection to a young African-American woman in New Hampshire. And then, of course, there's a lot of activism around African-American education in Boston. And so that sort of became the sort of subject and the mapping, really, of the book.
And broadly speaking, what were the education options for African-Americans pre-Civil War in the North?
So there were not very many options for African-Americans, men or women. So you have African-American men who sometimes were able to go to what we call hilltop colleges, like Amherst College, Bowdoin College. So you might have one or two Black men who are able to go to those institutions. For the most part, though, it's pretty rare. For African-American women, it's even more limited. Colleges usually only accepted men, and women oftentimes ended up going to what we call seminaries, which had less to do with religion, actually, in the 19th century. Here we're talking about seminaries and academies, and there was a very clear curriculum that they got there, and those institutions didn't accept African-American women for the most part. So African-American children sometimes had access to a segregated school in their town or city. And that was usually limited to the primary level. And sometimes there would be an opportunity to go to a grammar school, in rare, rare cases, high school. So we're talking about extremely limited opportunities when we're thinking about schools. African Americans, some were able to pursue private schooling or tutoring or Sunday schools. So they found ways that sort of fit their life. If there were issues around finances, you know, they were trying to find means to learn, but they didn't have sort of an educational system that welcomed them at all. I will mention Oberlin College is sort of one of the few places that accepted men and women, Black and white. So it's an extremely important institution in the pre-Civil War era to get an education.
Are there any local stories from your research that you'd like to share?
Sure. So there's one local story that involves an African-American woman named Rosetta Morrison, born in the 1810s in Connecticut. And it seems as though, it's not really clear from the historical record, but it seems as though she was orphaned. And at that point, because she was orphaned, she was what we call bound out to service, which means she became a servant in a white household. But this household was interestingly in Exeter, New Hampshire. And she ended up staying in that household for a number of years. It's not clear exactly how long, but I think there's a parallel between her story and that of Harriet Wilson's, because they were servants actually around the same time, different places in New Hampshire, but still both servants. It doesn't seem that Rosetta dealt with the kind of abuse that Harriet did, but they probably did the same kinds of chores, the same kind of labor, you know, in these white homes. Rosetta was able to get an education a little bit in this household. They actually, the family said that they would educate her, and they did. So that actually prepared her to go to a seminary. So she's one of the few examples we have of an African-American girl and young woman who's prepared to go to a female seminary. And she does go to one in upstate New York. But it seems like she's spending her formative years in Exeter, New Hampshire. So that was an interesting link that I wasn't expecting to find.
And what was something you learned through your research that was surprising?
You know, one thing that was surprising, it's more about the process. When I started writing this book, which comes out of my dissertation, I was concerned I wasn't going to find a lot of information. So, you know, I'm thinking about going to archives and sort of finding manuscripts and letters and other kinds of documents. And I'm thinking, I'm not going to find a lot on African-American girls and women who pursued education or who were engaged in educational activism. I wasn't expecting to find a lot. I was like, well, if I find a little bit, I can make it work. What was really surprising was that I did find a lot of material, so much material that I couldn't put it all in this book. There's actually more of a story to write about Black women in education. So I see the book as being a start along that path, but there's so much more that we can say, especially as it connects the 19th to the 20th century.
In Pursuit of Knowledge will be available in fall of 2019, and Harriet Wilson's novel is available at Portsmouth Public Library. We have a copy in Adult Fiction under Wilson.
Something is missing from the library. The gold eagle sculpture, which hangs in the stairwell, has been taken in broad daylight. Not by any thief, but by a conservator. Yes, that's right. The Liberty Eagle has flown the nest. Thanks to a generous grant from the Rosamund Thaxter Foundation, we are having the eagle conserved. Now, what does that mean? Well, if you've recently stood in the stairwell and looked down at the eagle, you can clearly see cracks in the wood and places where the gold leaf has worn through and the wood itself is visible. This is pretty understandable considering the eagle was built in 1824, making it 195 years old. The eagle was carved by Laban Beecher to sit on top of Liberty Pole in Prescott Park. The sunlight, heat, and corrosive sea air gave the wood a beating. Sun streams into the stairwell where the eagle currently roosts, exposing the eagle to harsh light and changing temperatures as the stairwell heats up and cools down over the course of days and seasons, causing the wood to expand and contract. Plus, it's been gathering lots of dust, and cleaning it ourselves could cause the gold leaf to flake off more. In order to properly conserve the eagle, we've teamed up with conservator John Brandon from East Point Conservation Studio in Maine. He's taken the eagle to his studio where he'll fill in the cracks and stabilize the wood and the gold to protect it from further wear and tear. We're also going to put a protective film over the windows and the stairwell to cut down on the UV rays that are harmful to the carving. The Liberty Eagle has long been a symbol of both the community and the library, representing our commitment to preserve history and to serve Portsmouth. In 4 years, Portsmouth will celebrate its 400th anniversary. We think our eagle friend deserves to shine bright in 2023, and that's why we're taking these steps to ensure it will be protected for future generations.
On Sunday, September 9th, 2018, the library hosted a reception for the Culture Keepers Culture Makers exhibit. As part of the project, 14 students led by Kristen Butterfield and Richard Haynes worked together to create art that speaks to a culture of diversity and connectedness. Panelists heard in this recording include Kristen Butterfield, Sylvia Foster, Richard Haynes, Ken Mendes, and Joy Miser Mendes. Here is Richard Haynes on how the project got started.
So let me tell you a little about the racial unity team. 4.5 years ago, there was a shooting in South Carolina at AME Church. 9 people lost their lives. I live outside of Exeter in Stratton, and I went to my church and said, well, we should have a memorial service. That's a good idea, right? So we had a nice memorial service, and then, you know, there was prayer, and we identified the people that were killed, the 9 people. Everybody went home on Saturday, and Sunday I'm in service and saying, is that it? 9 people lost their lives. Is that it? So I said, I've got to organize something different. So pulled together some people and we formed the racial unity team. So we hooked up with the Historical Society in Exeter. We looked at the history of Exeter and said, African Americans were displaced, Native Americans were displaced, Asian Americans were displaced. So there was a lot of things happening in Exeter, and I said, you know what, we need to remind people of the history, and from the history we learn how to deal with the future. So with that, we also had a program that we said, you know what, we need to educate people, because, you know, walks on ice, protesting has got a cause, but education is what changes people, and conversation with that education. Because you can go to a conference on racial unity, spend 8 hours with somebody and go home, and that's it. But you have to build relationships. Sylvia?
She's right
there. Said, you know what? Let's get a grant to have a program where we bring people together, talk about diversity, talk about inclusion, and then put that up in art. So that's what we're doing, and that's what we're here, and so I'm going to turn that over to you.
We're going to throw it to Sylvia first.
Talk about that. So
chronological.
This was a place where I thought the arts could save us. We've had so much in the news that's just been so negative, and I think we all want to be better humans, and I think that poetry, literature, canvas art can depict something that just hits us just right to say, oh, we could do this, we can do this. Change. So the people at the Miniature Charitable Foundation thought it was a good idea. So we were really pleased that we got $5,000 to bring Richard Haynes on board, and he is an amazing art teacher. I definitely learned how to be a better human from Richard. I mean, those days I wrote it, maybe it's in this little piece here, that we laughed and cried and imagined a better life. And Richard was, and Kristen was amazing. I mean, she started from the beginning giving us these YouTubes that just went, you know, snap, okay, I get it now. Music, she asked us to bring things in, so we brought ourselves, but we were encouraged to be more.
So my name is Richard Haynes, I'm a Portsmouth resident, and I do believe in the power of art. Now, all of a sudden, we were all God. A new species of people would walk in this room today and pull back the cobwebs of the Levinson room. Wow! And all of a sudden they'll unearth all of this and they'll begin to look at these images on the wall. What is the message? What is the message? And I couldn't think of a better way to really deliver that message. Think of how many people were on Broadway yesterday, going into Hamilton, or going into some other play. How many people will get online yesterday, and the power of art is what I'm talking about now, and went into movie theaters and saw these great movies, and went and heard poetry being read, and went yesterday at the Met, early in the morning, 10 o'clock. People are lined up those steps to go and see great sculptures and whatever else is in that museum. Artists are cultural keepers and cultural makers. And we are to learn from this. What 1960s, James Brown sang a song that turned African Americans around. What was the name of that song? Say it loud. I am black and I am proud. African Americans started wearing afros and dashiki. John and Yoko Ono sang a song. All we are saying is give peace a chance. J. Edgar Hoover wanted to shut it down, but that war ceased. The power of art. Artists are cultural keepers and cultural makers. But one thing for sure, transition to another great person. We can't do it alone. We cannot do it alone. We must come together for extraordinary dialogues to understand our differences. And how can we build and change the world in what we do? And we need hearts who are ready to make a difference in the world. People who are willing to live it on a day-to-day basis. Some years ago, I was fortunate working at University of New Hampshire, sitting next to Kristen Butterfield over here, and we would have some heated discussions about race, racism, if you name it. And when I thought about when Sylvia called and asked me to do this artistic side of it, I said, I need somebody from a majority descent to literally facilitate this conversation, because sometimes when black people want to talk about being black
in America, you know, all we have is that black story again.
I heard it.
I decided I need someone with a heart truly understands and truly could see through this mess. And there was no greater person to have that conversation with. I called, she's my daughter, Kristen Butterfield.
With the vision that Richard shared in terms of cultural keepers and cultural makers, we wanted to have a dialogue that everyone could come into. Wherever people were in their conversation, in their story, and in their understanding, we would all have a space in the conversation. So we did. We had three dialogue sessions. So we had a wonderful group of people brought together by Ken, Joy, and Sylvia in Exeter. And Richard and I just talked about, what do we really want to talk about here? What do we want people to go away from? And what I learned about this in this process is that everyone really wants to talk and understand. We were all coming from a place of really wanting to make the world better and really wanting to have conversations about race. And I think sometimes when you come into a space, you're not sure if people are really going to want to engage. It turns out everyone was so engaged and so willing to share their stories, and I don't understand this, and what is this? And so we watched some videos. We looked at how early racism comes into all of us, how early young children who are identifying dolls and thinking, well, I would rather be the white doll than the black doll, and at ages of 1, 2, and 3 years old. And so we talked about, what does that mean, and how early we learn these messages of what race is in our society. And we talked about the power of a single story. If we only have one story about a group of people, that means that we're missing all the other pieces of who they are, and we're making decisions based on those people in that one frame of reference that we have. And so we are trying to just broaden our understanding. And from that, the idea was, well, how do we make our community better? And so these are the pieces that came out. Every single person from that conversation then got to design an art piece that they felt represented not only the conversation, but their vision for the better world. So then if it gets uncovered in the future, what message do we want to give people about who we are and who our community is? And then when it was all finished, we voted on a piece that we wanted to be our big mural that represented all of us in our conversation. So we chose this large piece, and then we all worked together to paint this piece. And then the words around the outside, after each of our dialogues, before we left, we would each say one word about how we were feeling that evening based on our conversation. And so this was a way to have all of us represented in the painting. So this is what we were all feeling as we had these dialogues and came together. And I think what was amazing about this process is not only the conversations that we had in the beginning, but then as we created art over the next 4 weeks, we met twice a week for about 6 weeks, I think. Mm-hmm. The dialogues we'd have as we were coloring would continue, and we would continue to get to know each other, continue to dig deeper into those conversations, and it really felt like a family by the time we were finished. We kind of all had this just great care for each other. It was an amazing process, and as people shared, the power of art is that it brings people together, and everyone can see themselves in those pieces and interpret them to understand the idea of racial unity.
There's several artists in the room, so maybe if the artist would like to say a little bit about their pieces, would probably be good.
Hi, I'm Renee. This is my piece right here. There's a strand of DNA running behind. I really don't have a lot of interracial type experience. However, what inspires me is like the feminine divine, the goddess. And I had seen a photograph from Baton Rouge of a woman getting arrested. And I had looked at that photograph so many times over the last, I don't know, year or so. So I decided that that was the photograph that I would choose. The message in it, even though the two SWAT guys are kind of arresting this woman, I changed it so that their hands are touching in a heart. And then the DNA runs behind, signifying that we're actually all one person, all one race. There's not a lot of genetic difference.
Well, I'm Ken Bendis, and this is my piece. What you have is the world, a dog, and what I tried to do was show that the world is supported by people. The people on the right here are heroes. You have the blacks, the browns, the whites. They are reaching, but they're not there yet. Mm-hmm. The ones here are multicolored, meaning they have integrated into the races, accepted the different races. We're hoping that these hands will somehow, as you go to the left, you can see it gets a lot more colorful.
Yeah.
That means the one on the left here has broadly accepted that the world is multicultural. So that's what I tried to do, and obviously the dog is coming out of the people here trying to reach out to the others.
I'm Joy. I'm Ken's wife. I remember about 40-some years ago, I was thinking about race, people of different races, and I remember thinking in my youth, I think that people ought to be required to marry someone of a different race so that in a few generations we could all be the same color. And that was the guy. Yeah. I had no idea I was actually going to marry someone in my 30s and have a mixed up family. You know, our family is kind of like the United Nations. But this is my piece over here. So this reflects this to me. Most intimate of relationships is that of the family. And so here I have a family. The original was a black woman and a white man, and they're beautiful tan children. But blue and yellow make green. So Richard encouraged me to not be realistic at all in my colors as I started out. But this just represents the intimacy of really mixing it up in your own family.
Jerry, look like you had a question.
Yeah, I'd like to say something, if you don't mind. One of the things that we as humans do when we look at history and we read about it, whether it's art, music, or whatever, we don't usually ask ourselves where that came from. Mm-hmm. Or we don't spend any time trying to determine what does that really represent. And I'll give you a prime example. The 25th dynasty is something we never hear about. The 25th dynasty was by the Nubians in Africa who were in touch, were in charge, and those were the people that took over the Egyptians. Okay? They were called the Arrow people. When their sculptures were discovered by a German archaeologist, his first comments were that this couldn't have been done by people of color. Okay. If you ever have a chance to go to the Cairo Museum, you will see a block for every dynasty except the 25th. So we have to ask ourselves sometimes, what's really missing here? The pyramids, okay? Egyptians look like us in this room, those of color. They're not white. If you look at real Cleopatra, you know, Elizabeth Taylor, you know, that didn't work too well. You know what I'm saying? So and I don't say that from a negative standpoint. I say it from a knowledgeable standpoint. You have to go back sometimes and find out what was told to you and then ask yourself a question, well, why was it that way?
Yeah.
Because it goes for years and years and years and years and years. Mm-hmm. But the 25th dynasty, to this day, is not represented at the Cairo Museum for that very reason. Mm-hmm.
I think we should take this for a back to Christ. Was Christ white with blue eyes?
Oh, yeah. I was being nice.
Thank you for that. And I think that is so important and so much a part of our conversation and the idea that certain people get to write history and certain people get to tell it the way that reflects them. And so part of our thing was deconstructing that and thinking, what are the messages we got and why and who created them and who's missing? And then to perhaps try to rewrite it in a different way. So thank you, because that is a lot of our idea behind it.
That's exactly what we're trying to do. That we once were, and we were all annihilated and disappeared. What is the message being left this time? What is the message being left? What do we unearth? What do we discover then about the culture?
Welcome to the Hype Train. I'm Michaela, Emerging Technologies Library Assistant at the Portsmouth Public Library, and here to hype things we love around here. Joining me today is Mary Jo, part of our dynamic Dynamo team, reader of graphic novels, and all-around enthusiastic circulation assistant.
Agreed.
Today we're talking about Saga, the graphic novel series written by Brian K. Vaughan and illustrated by Fiona Staples. We'll keep our discussion to the first three volumes or so, but there are 54 issues in 9 volumes that are available in print here at the library, but also digitally through Hoopla. This is the story of two soldiers from opposite sides of a never-ending galactic war falling in love. They risk everything to bring a fragile new life into a dangerous old universe. Saga is the sweeping tale of one young family fighting to find their place in the world. Fantasy and science fiction are wed like never before in this sexy, subversive drama for adults. R-rated. Not for kids.
And there's definitely a lot of political intrigue that I noticed in these volumes.
Lots of political and familial and lots of drama, but it's funny and it's heartwarming and it's the family dramedy I never knew I wanted. The main characters, Marco and Alana, are star-crossed lovers, parents to little Hazel, and inconveniently, fugitives on the run from their respective planetary governing bodies. The series sits firmly in the sci-fi camp, which is not usually my thing, but the characters are relatable and diverse and very, very human in their mistakes and actions and relationships. And everyone is so well-rounded. Nobody's evil. Nobody's good. Everybody is kind of a mix in the middle, like most humans. I love the art style. It's just fabulous.
I was really impressed that she does such a wonderful job of creating scenes that are affecting. Her art is just very emotional, her expressions and of her characters. And she's also really good at making some very unsettling images. Very unsettling. Like, yes. When she's good at that. Like the creepy spider lady.
Yes, the stalk.
It's terrifying.
One of the main villains. She's my least favorite character, mostly because she's mostly a spider. Too many legs.
And her eyes, like, and she looks like... I kind of skipped over those pages. Like, I don't want to look at her for too long.
But she does. The artist, Fiona Staples, does a really great job, especially with some of the characters who don't have human faces.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole race, and they have TV monitors for faces. So kind of meeting that challenge of emoting and getting a point across without, you know, usual facial expressions is really impressive, and she does a really excellent job with that. And you mentioned kind of making you feel things through the art. She does, no spoilers, but at the very, very end, there's a kind of super climactic scene where there's no dialogue. It is just the art kind of getting the whole point across, and she does a really, really good job of kind of breaking your heart and then stomping on it without text. It's great.
I do recommend these stories to patrons looking for a super unique read, because this is, I think, one of the most unique stories I've read in what feels like a long time. And it's just very weird, but in a good way, and like it's not what you expect. If you told me like this is what this book is about, I wouldn't have believed you. It's just really unique and different. And I don't feel like I'm just saying that a lot, but it's true. It's a very unique story.
It is, and it's definitely, that's what grabbed me. Like I said, I don't read a ton of sci-fi, like, set in space. I hate space. Freaks me out.
Yeah.
But this is, because of the characters, I think, it really makes it relatable to readers of many genres.
Mm-hmm. I feel like it kind of, I don't know, these books kind of lost me after book one, though. Like, I loved book one. I thought it was just so well done, very compact. The story really flowed well. But then book two kind of lost me, and then book three was better, but I don't know if I'm going to continue. It wasn't my bag. I think book one was my favorite, but it kind of lost me after a while.
It definitely kind of spirals out into other characters and storylines,
yeah.
And that is, unfortunately for me,
yeah.
The Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples are taking a hiatus after the 9th volume, which came out last fall, so they are still on a break, and that was part of the reason, part of the explanation was they really wanted to create the best product that they could, and they felt like they were kind of losing it and a little burnt out from lot of writing.
I do respect that, though, that they're obviously serious about this, that they want to do a good job.
Right, take time, regroup, kind of figure it out, and tighten the story up again.
I would have liked it better if it was just their story and maybe one other plot line, but you get into the story of one of the assassins and one of the people who are chasing him and someone else, and, like,
there is a lot
happening,
and they are, everything is kind of tied to Alana and Marco and Hazel, but sometimes those ties are a little bit tenuous, and you're kind of like, how is this all related again? And it does kind of all come together again at the end of volume 9, which is another heartbreaker. But it does take 9 volumes to get to that point. And it is like I said, it's Hazel's story, but at the end of volume 9, she's only 8, maybe? So
Yeah.
Getting her whole up to adulthood is going to take a while, I think. So it's certainly a saga. A really interesting interview that I read while preparing for this podcast. Fawn was talking about that aspect of fictional war where it's just this endless war. Nobody really remembers why they're fighting or who started it or who was oppressed.
War hurts people. Like, it's war's not good. And I think, like, it's really obvious, but all these people have all been affected in different ways. He really does a good job of showing the way that these people have been changed because of this war, and
it shapes their reactions, and relationships, and interplanetary relations. If you are interested in reading these, they are here at the library. You can put them on hold or give us a call at 603-427-1540, and we'll put them on the shelf for you. Or they are always available through Hoopla and on their app or your computer.
Titus, you've only worked at the library for a limited time, and now you're leaving to move your family to Spain. Suffice to say, you've been a breath of fresh air and a tremendous contributor, and we're really sad to see you go. But before you leave, we want our listeners to get to know a little bit about you. So why don't you tell us what's been your role at the library?
I was fortunate enough to be looking at the postings when I applied for the library assistant position for circulation. And that's what I am. I work at the circulation desk part-time, about 25 hours a week.
What drew you to want to work at the library?
My undergraduate degree, which I did at Occidental College, I've worked at a library. I worked there for my whole 4 years through a work-study program. I worked in graduate school at the Art Institute of Chicago at their library for a couple years, and then I also worked at the museum library at the Art Institute of Chicago for a few years as well. So library work had been in my background and something I wanted to get back to.
You've hinted at this a little bit already, but I'd like to know, what interests do you have outside of the library that may have informed your work at the library?
Well, I'm an artist, and I studied art in graduate school and kind of veered away from it after I graduated because of the crushing debilitation of debt when you graduate. But since then, I've, gotten liberated in my mind and decided to continue making my artwork full time to be true to, my desires as well as a way to go through life, really. What was the question again?
What interests do you have outside the library?
My interests outside of the library are painting. I try to make a practice of painting almost daily, and that's my main interest outside of the library. The way that the library work has really informed and been helpful for me is having access to so much information, diverging thoughts on certain topics, the ability to do research. Also see, what's going on in not only the literary world, but also in cinema and in arts, depending on what we're purchasing and why. Also having access to interlibrary loan has been outstanding resource for me.
Great.
In terms of research, things I'm interested in for my artwork.
So you're going to be moving to Spain. Where in Spain is your family moving, and how do you envision your life looking in Spain?
Ashley and I, Ashley's my wife, and we're actually bringing our cat, Zola. We're moving to Madrid, Spain. Madrid is in central Spain. It's the capital. It's a big city. It's very much has the feel of a New York-type city. There's also a country house that my parents had gotten maybe 25 years ago now that really hasn't changed in value, and part of our work there is going to be fixing that up so that we can perhaps put it on the market to contribute to my mom's retirement. So that's a big job on top of really trying to get ingrained with the culture there, which I've never done fully, having grown up in California and, been in the States my whole life.
Fascinating. That I'm going to jump to a different question than I had expected to, which is that you grew up born in Madrid and raised bilingual, but that you never mastered either language. So I'd like to know if you could master English or Spanish, which would it be, and which one draws you in the most, and why?
You know, I like nonverbal languages. That's what I tend to draw to. But you know, you have to interpret things. You have to interpret meaning and be able to describe it to others, especially as an artist when you're trying to either apply for grants or really just introduce people to your work. You know, I don't think I'd have a choice of either one. My choice would be to have both mastered and maybe perhaps throw on another one. So that's my goal, is really to start mastering my bilingualness.
And so it sounds like you think of your art as a language.
Correct.
So if you could have dinner with one artist, alive or dead, who would you choose and what would you talk about?
That's a great question. You know, I think I would love to be reunited with my undergraduate professor, Linda Bessemer, certainly one of the largest influences on my life. First time I started painting was in her painting intro to painting course. She's just a fantastic artist who, oddly enough, went to school in Indiana for her graduate degree, but she still teaches at Occidental College and is very well known in Los Angeles and in Southern California and collectors throughout, where she's been able to build her career. I'd love to sit down and have dinner with her, catch up.
Before I ask you a little bit about leaving the library, I wanted to read to our listeners one other paragraph that you wrote describing your art on your website, which is that your images consist of materials from a wide range of sources, including fluorescent acrylic from 2005, spray paint bought from my Amazon Prime membership, a tube or tub of gel medium I had shipped to me from Nova Color 20 years ago, and even parts of used stretchers. So does this amalgamation of ingredients in some way reflect who you are as a person or your life experience in general? What collection of life experiences have most impacted the piece of art that you have become as a person today?
That description was really a way for me to try to describe to someone reading that I'm a bit of a collector. I wouldn't go so far as say I'm a hoarder, but I am someone who likes to grab onto things for whatever type of meaning they might have, whether it be visual meaning I'm interested in or emotional meaning. It has some resonance for me. It's also related to how I've continually held on to my art practice as something that I would eventually do. And in the past, it would be like, well, when I have enough money to comfortably do this thing, I'll do it and I'll have all the stuff. And it was really a breakthrough working kind of for myself. I was selling airplanes for a little bit and we started this company and I realized, why am I doing this? Why am I working for other people when I could just be working for myself? And it got me back into my practice and using these materials that I had held on to with such longing to put them into work.
That's a different take on what I was expecting to hear, but that makes a lot of sense. So what will you miss most about leaving Portsmouth and the library in particular?
Really the people. I haven't had the opportunity to work in such an environment with such great individuals and create friendships in a workplace. Nice. Which is, you know, I've found it in my working career to be difficult to find, especially in the American workforce, which is where all my experience is in. Work is always a place where you want to get away from. I mean, I found the opposite happening here at the library, and I feel like that may be true for a lot of positions given the way the city runs, and that's just my opinion, but it seems to be the culture at large here.
Wonderful. What would you like our listeners to know about the Portsmouth Public Library that you think they might not already know or appreciate?
One thing, and this is just my opinion, but I think people don't fully grasp the amount of work that the library staff puts into serving the public at large in all aspects of how the library functions for the community. And I would implore anyone to start getting engaged themselves. You know, if it's just merely checking out books and you don't do that yet, or maybe getting involved with programs and you don't do that yet, or perhaps even asking about volunteer opportunities. It's one of the greatest cultural institutions that our government's ever set up, ever. And it's a great way to get involved with the community and not feel like you're the only one there.
All right, final question. What will the canvas of Titus Dawson's life look like in 10 years?
Well, one of the reasons why we're moving to Spain is that Ashley and I want to try to start a family.
Wonderful.
And having kids out there. So I would imagine in 10 years, I'll probably be a father and, probably still learning how to decrease any stress levels related to money, because I really feel like that has been a debilitating part of a big chunk of my life that I've finally been able to mentally get out of. I wouldn't say financially, but the rigors of capitalism can be quite stressful.
They can be tough. It's true. Well, listen, thank you so much, Titus, for working and contributing at the library. Thanks for being my first interviewee. You will be missed. Thanks so much.
This has been the fifth episode of The Parrot Unbound from Portsmouth Public Library. Special thanks to Portsmouth Community Radio, WSCA, for putting us on air. Thanks also to Cabria Bumgardner, Jerry Ann Bogus, Kristen Butterfield, Sylvia Foster, Richard Haynes, Joy Miser Mendes, and Ken Mendes. This episode was brought to you by Steve Butzel, Titus Dawson, Christine Fries, Grace Hanley, me, Laura Horwood Benton, Michaela Pugh, and Mary Jo Sergage, and Polina Vasiliev. Our theme music comes from Purple Planet Music. Until next time, happy reading.